Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we start our podcast today, let's talk about our website real quick. It exists, themacguffinmen.com. It's got approximately 228 episodes worth of content. We most recently talked about Bonnie and Clyde, Sicario before that, and then three parts on Seinfeld, which I still think is a really concise discussion of Seinfeld. I also wrote a thing about Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden's movies, which approximately two people have read. Maybe you can be the third. One of them is one of the directors, so that counts for something, right?
Absolutely.
But yeah, we're not talking about any of those things today, so we'll just get to our very musical theme song and move on.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes?
Unwrap that scrumdiddlyumptious bar. Let's talk about this film.
Okay, you don't sound excited at all.
I am not!
Why not?
I mean... I was not excited about doing this movie. We're doing Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, 1971 version.
The non-Johnny Depp version.
Yeah, exactly, which is also called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, so pretty easy to differentiate itself.
I call it Johnny and the Chocolate Factory, okay, but continue.
Killer joke. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the movies I've seen the most in my life, just because I've watched it a million times as a child, and... liked it a lot, obviously, but remembered it well enough to know that I wasn't really gonna like love my 99 minutes this afternoon, you know.
Yeah,
so like, it's got some good stuff. Gene Wilder's obviously great, but that's about it. Not crazy about the rest, you know.
Okay, so but you said you did watch it a lot as a kid.
Oh, tons.
And when was the last time you saw it before this?
When it, like, probably 10, somewhere in the 8 to 10 years ago range, when I worked at a video store.
Okay.
Would have just been on.
And did you ever read the book?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And did you like the book?
Oh, yeah. Big okay. Roald Dahl fan. I think you and I have talked about this. We were both Roald Dahl fans as children, right?
Yes. And adults.
Yeah.
Okay. So I know you know this, but just we'll blow through the kind of backstory quickly.
Okay.
As you said, this movie was made in 1971. Roald Dahl wrote a book in 1964 called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Mm-hmm.
And Mel Stewart, who is the director of this movie, his daughter read the book and liked it a lot and said to her dad that you should make this into a movie. Did you know the story?
No, but I'm just hearing it as Veruca Salt saying that to her director father.
Yeah. Oh, that would be good.
Yeah.
Also, Alex did convince me not to do this whole episode as Veruca Salt as much as I wanted to. Let's just get that out there quickly.
You're welcome. So I might be shitting on one of the favorite movies of your childhood, but at least I saved you from that.
Yeah, and people don't have to listen to me call you Dassy for an hour. So that's another win for the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so she liked the book so much she wanted to make it a movie, and Mel Stewart had a friend who was in talks with the Quaker Oats Company about they wanted to find some way to promote a company they'd started called Breaker Concessions, which is a candy company. And they kind of just put the two pieces together and turned Breaker Concessions into the Wonka candy company that we know and love today. And that's kind of the whole genesis of the way that this movie came about.
Yeah, well, we should point out we are both chomping on nerds right now.
Mine's a nerd rope, but yeah. Close.
Yeah.
And did you know kind of Roald Dahl's history with like chocolate and candy and how he got the idea for the novel initially?
No, I haven't read anything about Roald Dahl since I was like 14, you know? Oh,
man, he's awesome, by the way.
No, that does not surprise me at all. I've read, like, I think probably pretty much everything he ever wrote I read as a child, and more than once for most of them, and then just kind of, you know, you just run out of time with people, I guess.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. But his classroom when he was a kid in the 1920s, there was candy and chocolate companies that would use their class as kind of a focus group.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would sample all these chocolates. And chocolate companies around that time kind of had these very competitive kind of nature to them, the way he tells it. And there was Cadbury and Roundtree's, two English you know, candy companies, were actually known to like dress their own employees up as the other company's employees to send them into the factory and use them as spies. And, you know, just they would become very protective. And then kind of a writer's imagination took that idea to, you know, an extreme, and has Willy Wonka, who is, you know, extremely protective of his secrets and his factory, very much to an illegal degree, it seems. But I don't know how the food inspectors deal with that.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions that this movie brings up, but not very many answers.
No, that's true. Mm. Yeah, I just thought that that was really interesting, and you know, just the writer's imagination kind of turned that into the book, which our Veruca Stewart turned into a movie. Yeah. But yes, onto the movie.
Mm-hmm. Did you like this picture?
Yeah, I do a lot.
Okay.
I've seen it kind of more recently than you had too, so not a ton of stuff really surprises me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is a movie people love and don't remember that well.
Mm.
Like, I think that people do forget how long this movie goes on before we see Wonka the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of suspected that would be one of the parts of the movies that you did enjoy, like kind of that first 45 minutes to an hour before Wonka, before we even get to the chocolate factory.
I think it's about 45 minutes when they're standing out front of the chocolate factory.
Yeah. There's kind of that cool media angle to it that I think people just forget about. I think a lot of people's memory of this movie starts at, you know, the gates of the factory with maybe remember I got a golden ticket, but a lot of the stuff is forgettable for a bad reason. But I think,
like Cheer Up Charlie.
Oh, what a terrible song.
I got a funny story about that, is that the first approximately million times I watched this movie were on a taped off of television version, and that song was cut for time, I assume, or quality control, either one. And so, like, I mentioned that it would be on at the video store, and that would have been, like, the first time I heard this song and was like, what is the scene in this movie that I've seen a million times but was totally unaware of this scene, of this garbage song?
Yeah, and I think this movie did...
Let's watch a kid sadly walk throughout the streets for fucking 3 minutes. It was the most boring thing.
Yeah, well, I think this movie did kind of get a lot of its cult following from being aired on television a lot, so maybe that explains people's memory of it, that they just straight up cut some of the really bad slow parts of this movie. Because Cheer Up Charlie is bad, and not just because it's a slow, sad song, because you can write slow, sad songs that are worth your time.
Yeah, exactly.
This one is just, it's just bad wall to wall. But I do really like some of the stuff before that. And I thought that as an adult, this might be one of the things that you did like.
Yeah, no, and that's where most of the stuff that I did enjoy comes from. I can't think of a movie that has more separate newscasters in a film, like as characters. But I mean, I did certainly remember that aspect of it. Like Stanley Kale, he's the one that talks with like a very calming voice. He just always killed me as a kid, so I always remember that aspect of the movie, just because there are a lot of things about that aspect of the movie that were always entertaining to me, even before I thought about the media that much or the type of urban fervor that's going on in this movie. Those are some of the highlights, the weird cutaways with the computer.
I do love that. I'm now telling the computer exactly what he can do with the lifetime supply.
Exactly. I wasn't into that bit until that line, and that line's funny. And well done there. That and the hostage situation is a really good one as well.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't know. Certainly highlights, but
I like Mr. Gloop eating the mic as well.
I think that was something that even made me roll my eyes as like a 7-year-old.
It's pretty silly even for this movie, but I like it. And I like Violet's dad constantly plugging his car dealership.
Okay. Oh, the not until you're 12 son line is great. Did not remember it. Great line. Great delivery. Yeah.
Good little dig at American culture, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, all of Mike TV pretty lately exactly. is a bit of a criticism of American culture at the mm-hmm. time. But yeah, pretty good. Did you notice the camera outside of Wonka's factory? The one that
yes.
like, the one that's actually like a professional motion picture camera?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't even realize that till this time. But mm-hmm. That's a real camera that they used to produce this movie. And you can kind of line up the shots of what they actually used from that camera in this movie. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it also kind of makes sense that a 35 millimeter camera would be there. Like it's not crazy to assume that this apparently like uber famous person that everybody wants a piece of who is a recluse sort of just appears, you know, for the first time in years. It would make sense that somebody wants that footage, you know, like some sort of like news documentary crew or something like that, you know?
Yeah, no, so, absolutely.
Yeah. It's not nonsense that there's a giant camera in the crowd, especially with the media tie-ins that you've brought up from earlier in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brings up something I did want to talk about. And I think it adds to the appeal of this movie, I think, for kids. And it's not something I would guess that to be aware of, because it's not something I really thought about watching it as a kid. And enjoying it a lot, is that it is like it's a very kind of child-centric story. And I know that that seems, you know, very obvious because it's a kid's movie about five kids.
Yeah.
But it's just this idea that it's the leader of a candy company is like the biggest name. You know, he's just this massive celebrity and everybody knows about him and there's this mystery to him. And, you know, part of it is that he is a rich person who's a recluse. But I think those exist a lot, and I think that there's a lot of people who are like that, whose names we don't know and wouldn't bring a 35 millimeter camera to their front door if they did announce that they were coming out for the first time. And I think that's part of the appeal of this movie is that, you know, it's chocolate and it's candy and it's, you know, these very kind of this very childish subject is the biggest story in the news. You know, like there's this public craze. You know, as you said, the cameras, all the like, as you said, there's just so many news reporters in the front, you know, third of this movie and in different countries and things like that. And it's really just putting this childish subject, but all the adults in the world treating it like it is the most important thing in the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something that I found myself questioning a little bit. It's like, what is the importance of chocolate in this world, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's just kind of a kid's, it's never really mentioned that it's this kid's perspective blown up and put you know, the way that adults treat real news subjects, but I think that's part of the charm of it, and I think that that's something that kids can really kind of hook into within this movie, because it's treated like such a serious adult subject, but you know, it's just, it's candy and it's the guy who makes your favorite chocolate bar and things like that.
Yep.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of Wonka's character too, is just the way that he treats children versus the way he treats adults.
Yeah.
And I think at the factory, you know, little greeting thing, when he shakes hands with everyone for the first time and meets the kids he's going to be on the tour with, he's extremely dismissive of all the adults.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, like, for sure. He greets the children really warmly and just kind of brushes off all the adults and says, you know, just go follow your kid, whatever.
I would do the exact opposite.
Yeah. Yo, yeah. We were well aware that Willy Wonka is not you. And, you know, and kind of by that same note, all five winners of this contest are children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even Veruca's ticket was, you know, found by an adult, found by an adult, being paid by an adult, but given to her. And it's kind of this whole world where children are kind of the focus of all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You've heard the story about Gene Wilder and that entrance that he does make on along the carpet there.
How he demanded it be in the movie or whatever, like that was his condition for accepting the role.
Yeah.
Yes.
Think that's true?
No, it can't be. But also it can. It's Gene Wilder. I don't know, man. I believe anything.
True.
Yeah.
Do you like the intro, his intro?
Oh, it's great.
Why do you like it so much?
Because it's I mean, at this point, we've got 45 minutes of waiting to see this person. And we've got, even within that 45 minutes, all these people talking about how big of a wait it is for them outside of the movie time that we're experiencing. And then to have him just screw with everybody for a minute, you know, it's great. I like it.
Yeah, no, it's good. Did you hear his reasoning for wanting to enter the film that way?
No, or maybe I didn't, forgot.
But. Okay. Just that from that point on, you couldn't trust anything that character did.
Okay.
You kind of see him in one state and then very emphatically proves that that's, you know, not the case, that he doesn't have this physical disability and, you know, he's capable of all this goofy fun stuff, even though he looks kind of older and stuffier.
Yep, I get that.
Yeah. Did you get a bit of a Robert Downey Jr. vibe from him?
Yeah, I can get a little bit of that. Weirdly, I think there's more of a darkness to Gene Wilder than I think with Robert Downey Jr. And knowing full well that Robert Downey Jr. has had some very dark turns in his life, you know, there's just sort of like it's weird to say this about the one that didn't play Willy Wonka, but there is a playfulness in one of them that I think comes from a much, much safer place than what Gene Wilder's got going on. I don't know. There's something like really, it feels like there's just a corpse inside of him sometimes, you know, like he's just dead. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's part of his appeal in this movie, and certainly in this movie for me. But just in general, there's just this sort of just removal from humanity that I find really appealing. And I think you get a lot of that with Bill Murray sometimes too. You know?
Yes, I can see that.
Yeah.
But I just want to kind of plant a flag in that for a second, because I've been kind of negotiating with how dark this movie is and, you know, Wonka himself, and that it is a kid's movie and a very popular kid's movie. And what is it about kind of that darkness you're pointing to that doesn't just, like, within the character of Willy Wonka and, you know, as I've said, kind of pervasive throughout this movie, that doesn't just make this an awful experience that kids never want to go through again and would rather watch it over and over, as so many kids did?
Because the kids are the heroes. Like, Charlie is the hero because he is the one that has not yet grown up. And the kids that love this movie have not yet grown up, so they get to be the hero, right? Like, at the core, Wonka is this person that he wants to pass off his company to a child because he has aged into adulthood and realized that he's the only adult that he sees that has been able to hold on to this childlike imagination. And that's what he doesn't like about adults. And that's why he has to pass his company along to somebody that has no idea how to run a business, you know, but most likely, I mean, he delivers papers, but I don't know how much business knowledge he's got. He's got an MBA or
Charlie.
Yeah. And that's basically, that's the core of Willy Wonka, is he's a man that has lived long enough wanting to be a child and realized that it has passed him by and that all of his contemporaries are idiots. Like in from his perspective, like, he just doesn't like what people have become, people his age have become, and he doesn't trust them to continue on his vision. So, children.
Yeah. I do enjoy that Willy Wonka seems to dress the way that a 7-year-old assumes a rich person would dress.
Yeah, that, like, is true.
It's such a childish outfit, yep. Pretending not to be childish.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think Charlie Day in It's Always Sunny, when he plays a rich guy, basically dresses like that, you know, top hat and everything, which I think really fits with your theory.
Yeah, I saw someone describe Willy Wonka as someone with the fashion sense of a pretentious snowman. And I thought that was pretty good.
That's really funny.
Yeah, but to go back to your explanation of why he's giving it away to a child, the quote he gives near the end is, you know, when he's talking to Charlie and Uncle Joe about why he's giving the factory away to Charlie. And he says, not a grown-up. A grown-up would want to do everything his own way, not mine. So that's why I decided a long time ago that I had to find a child. A very honest, loving child to whom I could tell all my most precious candy-making secrets to.
Yeah.
But you said that Charlie's the only one who hasn't grown up.
He's grown up just enough to know not to be a bag of shit, and like to know to be good, and that's the thing that but he's still also a child, you know, so he's got this sort of trustworthiness that Wonka can get down with, but also still childlike, you know, because he's a child.
And we saw that when he gave the Gobstopper back.
The "so shines a good deed in a weary world" part. Yeah.
Some Wonka's poetry.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Wonka's quoting. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wonka's quoting of Merchant of Venice, I believe is what you mean.
Ooh, you knew which one it was.
It's the one that Al Pacino has done, you know. In a movie.
You fancy snowman, you.
Yeah, I am. So actually, Al Pacino kind of dresses like a fancy snowman in that movie.
I'm just trying to, like, I'm stuck on, first of all, we'll talk about Charlie for a second.
I'm still on Al Pacino.
Okay.
Sorry, continue.
Like most of this podcast, I'll just talk about this movie and you can just be stuck in your own head. First of all, this movie succeeds despite Charlie. There's not a kid I want to punch in the face more than Charlie Bucket.
Yeah.
Man, especially near the end when he's making that sad face.
Yeah.
It's pretty insufferable. but just kind of to go back to the ending, we've kind of seen throughout this movie there's just not much adversity for Charlie. I mean, once the tour starts, yeah. I mean, obviously he comes from a very impoverished family, and that's obviously very, very terrible and difficult for him and his family. But it's this kind of kid-like fantasy, and I think it ties in with what I was saying about this being such a child-centric movie, is all the adults in Charlie's life really seem to dote on him.
Mm-hmm.
His mother and Grandpa Joe do it in different ways, but it's all coming from a very positive place. But it's just a very just such a fantasy relationship between Charlie, who's our stand-in for, you know, childhood, and all the adults. Like, the mm-hmm. only person he gets any pushback from is Wonka, and we find out that that's only a test, you know, as though all the negativity any adults provide to you is fake and kind of this facade for you know, leaving you with all the chocolate you could ever want and wealth and lifting your family out of poverty and, you know, finding this friend in an adult who's really just a kid and who knew he loved you, you know, all along and this kind of thing. Do you think that makes any of this movie kind of ring false, or?
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't really ring true with me. Like it doesn't, I don't know. I don't have an answer because I haven't put that much thought into it, you know, because I didn't really like it enough to put that much thought into it, you know? And yeah. I know that's being dismissive of your point that is obviously well thought out, but yeah, that's my answer, you know? Like I say this all the time. If I don't like the movie enough to want to think about it, then I'm just not going to think about it, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So, yes, I don't know. you are probably right. I trust that your point is correct. Yeah.
No, I just mean like we've talked about in the book and the movie. There's this mm-hmm. kind of darkness to it. But do you think that and that does kind of add to its appeal? I think. But do you think it kind of sells itself short in the ending? Like it gets too sweet?
Well, it definitely gets too sweet for my liking. I mean, it is still a children's movie, you know? And I think, for a movie directed specifically at children, some of the stuff that we do get to see that is really weird, like especially the boat tunnel scene. I think getting those things in a movie like this is a small triumph in its own, you know, especially something this movie starts with candy companies wanting to make a movie, you know?
Yeah, no, so, absolutely.
So you're never going to get like David Fincher's child movie for kids, you know? But, you know, you got to take the good moments and be appreciative of them, even though they are vastly outnumbered, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and we also have, this is what I think a lot of people forget about because it is so brief and seemingly a non sequitur, but the axe sharpening guy.
Yeah.
It's the factory near the front of this movie.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, it's very heavy and weird.
Yeah, and just that's it. That's all you get.
Yeah.
Well, I think he was a tinkerer.
Yeah, what is that about?
I don't know.
Thanks for elucidating on that. Yeah. Well, one of my favorite kind of little dark pieces within this movie, and this is kind of, you need some knowledge outside of this movie to appreciate it, is, do you remember when there's the fake fifth winner, the guy who claims to have found the golden ticket so people stop looking?
Yes.
Do you know who that picture is?
He was a Nazi or something, right?
Yeah, like a pretty infamous Nazi henchman. And that's really dark and heavy.
Yeah.
For a movie that's already kind of pretty dark and heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just kind of ties into, I think, that idea, like, how kid-focused this movie is, and how, you know, that's what an adult is. That's the one adult, you know, almost ticket winner is, in this movie, a liar, but in real life, a Nazi. And that's just how kind of dark this movie is willing to go, and just the way that it paints children versus adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any of the songs you like in this?
A pretty, like, the Oompa Loompa song. Yes. Every use of that is my favorite song in the movie, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's the only standout. I like the staging of the Candyman song a lot. Just the performance aspect of it.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. There's just something about that candy shop that I think is just a really well-designed set. Like, and I know there's a lot of interesting sets in the factory, but there's something, I don't know, there's still something drab about the way people move throughout the sets in the factory. Like, it feels like it should be more exciting to me. But the Candyman, like, you can tell it's designed to be, because it's, when you see the shop from the exterior, it's a claustrophobic sort of space, and it kind of has that vibe even on the inside. And they're still able to do, I think, a pretty good number out of it, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that one's really good. Mm-hmm. And
I do wish Sammy Davis Jr. had played that part.
Yeah, that would have been next level.
Yeah.
Hey, he got a number one hit out of covering it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I like that one because, as you said, it is kind of a small space, but there's so much action, you know, the camera movement and the kids running around and dancing.
Yep.
And the fact that that song kind of ends with him going, okay, now you can rob my store while I rest my chin on my hand.
Yeah. Oh, the sweet old days when kids just got to rob stores for free or for, yeah, no, for nothing. You know?
Yeah. What about Veruca's song, I Want It Now?
Oh, great clothes. Great clothes on that one.
Because a kid dies?
No, I just, yeah, that is definitely the other one I liked.
Yeah, that's good. And I think Veruca is clearly the most talented of the kids in this movie.
I like Violet a lot, too.
Violet's a close second. Augustus is good, but he nails everything he has. He just doesn't get as much to work with. Veruca has the most to do, but I think does it the best. And I think it's telling that she's the only one of the kids that has a career in acting.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think that song's really good.
Volcano Girls?
Yeah. Volcano Girls, great tune. No, I think I Want It Now is really good. And I don't like when there's too much kind of choreography and synchronization in songs in musicals, which I know sounds silly because obviously they're all choreographed, but... Yeah. I like how she's running around and the Oompa Loompas are just kind of chasing her instead of everyone for some reason having a dance number that they can bust out.
Yeah.
And yes, her going down the chute at the end is very good.
Yeah, for sure.
Have you heard the theory about all the kids in this movie representing a different drug?
No.
Okay.
I'm already on board.
Yeah. It's not perfect, but here we go.
What super lame drug is Charlie?
Alcohol. So we'll go in kind of the order of their demise. We've got Augustus first. And this is kind of when they're just first in the factory and they get into that, you know, we get that big shot of them entering kind of the fun part of the factory, not just the small tunnels in the contract signing room.
Yeah.
And it's this big garden. And you sounded kind of underwhelmed by the visual aspects of it.
It's just there's something... There's just something missing about that set. I don't know, like, because there's obviously there's some wonderful design elements. It just, and maybe it's sort of a camera staging problem or something, but I don't know. It just feels like that set could have been better utilized or better designed and then better utilized. You know?
Okay.
It just feels like there's something missing from it.
Yeah. It does feel, I mean, I still think it's, I think my perception of it is still kind of tied up in seeing it as a kid. Looking at it now, it does kind of feel like a warehouse dressed up to be a fantastic place.
Exactly. It looks like a set. It's like the thing I always say about Tim Burton and David Cronenberg movies. Like the thing that bothered me about their movies is that their sets are made to look like sets. And this looks like a set, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It looks like the same space that they eventually shoot the all white TV space.
Right. Okay. So that's that area we're talking about, which has, you know, kind of a candy garden kind of feel. Mm-hmm. Everything there is naturally grown and it's our first place. So Augustus is marijuana because he's the gateway drug.
Okay.
We start where it's kind of the garden.
And he's got a killer case of the munchies.
It has got a killer case of the munchies.
Yeah, no, it's true. I am hilarious. Continue.
Yeah. And then we go on to Violet. And, you know, this is the 70s. And so she's diet pills, a.k.a. amphetamines.
Okay.
We've got this chewing gum that's kind of representing food. And it gives you kind of the whole experience of eating a whole meal, but without actually having to eat anything and supposedly gain weight. Mm-hmm. So that's the end of Violet.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Veruca. Want to take a guess?
I don't know. Cocaine?
Obviously cocaine. Okay. If Veruca's going to be on a drug, it's clearly cocaine. The rich person.
I don't know. I guess I don't think about 10-year-olds on drugs all that frequently.
She's not on it. She is it.
Okay. I'm so sorry. I guess I don't think of 10-year-olds as drugs all that frequently.
Yeah. But it's the rich person's drug, and she's very paranoid and loud, and her name's Veruca Salt, and Salt kind of looks like cocaine.
Okay, I'm not on board with that last one.
Damn it. She dies going onto a very big scale after being loud and obnoxious and then disappears. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mike TV, awful name. He's LSD.
Mm-hmm.
He's always kind of immersed in these other realities when he's watching television. You know, and his death is in a room with people kind of experimenting with perceptions of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And as we already got to, Charlie's alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the fizzy lifting drink. What, no good?
No, I'm laughing because it's funny.
Okay. And his grandpa gives him the idea. And it's kind of this this notion that it's kind of the oldest drug, so it's probably the best one. You know, it's not really good, but it has kind of been grandfathered in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a good way of putting it. Like,
yes, my wording.
we get it. You're a genius.
It's not mine, but that part is. And yeah, it's as we see kind of at the end, it's the socially acceptable drug. It's the one he gets away with. There's no real comeuppance in the long term. You know, he kind of has a bit of a moral hangover from it when he gets in trouble, but it's the drug that's okay, and that's why he reaps the benefits of society in Willy Wonka.
Yeah, and Wonka does have the alcoholic's rage too, so it makes sense that he would.
Yeah, and there's some jokes about him bootlegging as well.
Mm.
So why do you think this movie is as popular as it is?
I think a part of it, a big part of it, is the whole like magic treehouse factor of the factory, I guess. Kids really enjoy like that Swiss Family Robinson vibe of, whoa, look how crazy this environment is. Wouldn't it be fun to go hang out in it? You know,
yeah.
I think that always counts for something with children, or at least that's something I have found with people my age and the movies that they liked a lot. I was just talking to somebody about Casper recently, and I think the house that's a big part of Casper.
Yep.
That's part of it. It's a musical. Kids like musicals, I guess. And the kid wins. I don't know. Kid triumphs. And kid gets to run a chocolate factory at the end.
Yeah.
I feel like for 8-year-old idiots, that's a good career aspiration. I'm saying that as a former 8-year-old idiot, you know?
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah.
I probably really wanted to run Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. That's probably why I love this movie.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else to say about Willy Wonka?
I like every time that a child is in mortal danger and somebody asks Willy Wonka to help. He's like, help, please.
Yeah, I
know.
Kills
me every time.
I was looking through just a list of quotes from this movie right before this to see if there's kind of anything else I missed. And after, like, for almost all his lines, it says Willy Wonka, colon, and then square brackets, unenthusiastically, and then whatever it is he says, like, no, police, murder, stop. Like,
it's so great. I love it.
Yeah, it's got that kind of teenage sarcasm to it. You know, like, as you said, he's not quite a kid anymore, but he's not taking things seriously as an adult. He's smart enough to understand the danger, but since he's a kid, he doesn't really give a shit. And he kind of has that kind of teenage, middle of the road cynicism to it, which I think speaks to everything else about his character.
Yeah, and one of the things I did enjoy about Wonka is how quickly if somebody does something that he views as wrong, like, they're just dead to him immediately. And that's very present in all of those scenes. Pretty much every time somebody asks him to do something, it comes right after one of these kids has wronged him or done something in his factory that he deems off limits. And he's just like, no, I don't care, you know. And I like that a lot. You know, I like that. I like somebody with that really strong division, you know.
Yeah. You get nothing, you lose.
Well, I mean, that scene is obviously great. Yeah. Anytime Gene Wilder yells in this movie, I think, look, Gene Wilder's great in this movie, is what I'm saying, top to bottom.
No one's gonna argue that.
I also really like the LSD scene, as you might put it, but Mike TV's death scene, you know. I think that whole environment's really great. And
why do you like that so much?
I don't know. It's just weird. It's like weird in the way that I feel like the boat scene is weird, in that it just doesn't feel like a kid's movie in that scene. And it's a little bit off-putting. And I don't know. Just the whole thing is just kind of bizarre. And I really like it.
Yeah. And I think it's weird in a different way, because so much of this movie, you know, like the boat scene, it's so colorful and fast, and then we go into there's weird noises, and not just in the boat scene, but all the musical numbers when we see the Oompa Loompas in the factory, the kind of candy garden that we were discussing earlier. There's so much going on, and that's, you know, maybe that ties into the things you're saying that kids like about the Weird House and Casper and the Swiss Family Robinson. There's all these new kind of contraptions and different objects, but there's just kind of this bleak, you know, blank whiteness to that room, and it really, I think it really does kind of change the tone of it, but stays being very weird, obviously, but I think in kind of a different way.
Yeah, for sure. One other thing I wanted to talk about, the waiver that they sign at the beginning, and the sort of the terms and conditions thing, like that scene is straight out of Ex Machina, you know, and I really enjoyed it, you know?
Yeah.
And it leads into the one question I was thinking about a lot during this movie. What company today could cause this type of thing? Like, when people are freaking out trying to get all these Wonka bars to get a look into this factory. Like, what company could cause anything comparable?
Partially because I think the leader, and just, I can't think of a company that's caused the hysteria, but maybe Apple 10 years ago.
That's the answer I had. And obviously the cost of their products is kind of prohibitive to allowing this type of thing to happen. You know, what's the cheapest thing Apple makes, you know? I guess iPod shuffles are flying off the shelves. But yeah, and I think, you know, and I mean that we're probably looking at the design labs as being the victory and not the factories in China.
Yep. I don't think... ones with the suicide nets around them, because Steve Jobs, the Buddhist, loves his employees so much. Yeah, those ones. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, the that was just the only thing I could come up with. It seems like the only modern company that people would climb over themselves to take a look at.
Yeah, and I think that has to be it. And, you know, as I said, it's because it had this leader that people knew about, you know, the way that they know about Wonka. People knew about Steve Jobs. You know, I'm not going to get into what credit he deserves and things like that, but he's just a name that everybody knew. And if there was a ton of secrecy that the way there is around Wonka, around Apple, as I said, probably a decade ago would have been the prime of it, right?
iPhone, I think, is 2007. So I think that would be what I would say is like the, I think,
yeah.
And this is coming from somebody that is kind of a Luddite, but I think that's kind of like the biggest moment of Apple when I think about its actual effect on the world.
Yeah, no, I think so too. And I think that kind of ties into what I was saying earlier. I think that for the world to go crazy over, you know, iPhones and iPods and, you know, the user-friendly laptops that they had, being something that really changed things.
User-friendly computers in general, you know, not just laptops.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, I don't want to overstate how important they were, but I think it was something that people really did think was very cool and cutting edge and was, you know, very trendy in a way at that time, especially. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, people have done real things on computers and with, you know, some of the technologies that Apple has put forward. And it makes sense for kind of the world to be very curious about how it all happened and, you know, where they get the ideas and things like that. And that's why I think part of what this movie is such a kid's fantasy for is that they're doing that, but with candy and chocolate. Something yes. That is, you know, as much as you might like chocolate, it doesn't have the same effect on the way the world does business or the way the world enjoys themselves or the way the world creates music and shares music and things like that. So, just the idea that it's a chocolate bar or a gobstopper that gets kind of the whole world looking at this one person and going nuts in this whole contest and, you know, auctioning off one box of chocolate bars and having factories turned into candy bar unwrapping factories, is, I think, part of the appeal of this movie. And just that something so childish really can take over the whole world, I think, is a very, maybe not realized kid's fantasy, but just the way that they would approach the world, you know?
Mm-hmm. All right, it's settled. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory reboot, written by Aaron Sorkin.
Seth Rogen is an Oompa
Loompa. So thanks for listening to the McGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next time.
Thanks for listening to the McGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themcguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.